Arrival.
Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before I introduce our favorite guest, I just want to comment on the news where you had idiots and around the world celebrating Easter. Keep in mind that if man can kill God, that isn't much of a God. And why would anyone in their right mind want to trust their life to a God who men were able to kill? Seems pretty stupid to me, beyond the fact that the whole concept of Easter is purely Babylonian, including its name. Dying and resurrecting gods are an essential aspect of almost every pagan religion the world over. There are very few religions, however, as rotten as the one we're going to speak of next. And it's kind of interesting today. Many of our topics are going to be comparative topics, where we're going to compare what is said in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms to what a wannabe God named Allah has to say in his Quran. It is my pleasure to welcome back to the program my good friend, IQ Al-Rasuli. IQ is the author of a series of books called Lifting the Veil, The True Faces of Muhammad and Islam. Just for fun, over the last few minutes, I Googled Lifting the Veil, IQ, and the first 10 links were all to IQ and his books. So if you wish to buy a copy, and I have all three, then all you need to do is Lifting the Veil, IQ Al-Rasuli. IQ, welcome back to the program.
Thank God I'm back again.
Yes. We missed you last week. I'm glad to have you back. You are I think, the most well-informed and reasoned individual in the world when it comes to exposing and condemning the myths that are spread by Islam, which is, in my view, the most deadly, the most destructive, the most deceitful political and religious dogma that has ever been perpetrated on humankind.
You're very kind. A compliment from you is equal to 10,000 PhDs from any university.
I wish that were true, but it is one of the things that I think I can speak with a reasonable authority on is Islam. Like you, I've taken the time to study it, I've taken the time to write about it, taken the time to speak about it publicly, and in having done so, I'm always amazed by how effective your witness is in this regard. And the reason we devote time to this is because not only today, but over the next 20 years, Islam is going to continue to be among, if not the most lethal threats to humankind. And so there is no issue other than actually reading the Torah and coming to find out who God is so that you might save yourself from this mess. You don't save yourself, but enable God to save you from this mess. There's really nothing we can do that better prepares us for what is to come than understanding Islam. And the more people who understand, who expose and condemn this disgusting religious and political system, the safer we will all be. So with that in mind, let's go to point 20 of your irrefutable contradictions in the Quran or statements in the Quran that show Islam to be foolish. Any enlightened person knows that as an essential, in fact, the most essential aspect of Yahweh's Torah teaching, that he introduced his covenant, and that among the benefits of the covenant was that we those who participate get to live with Yahweh, and the symbol of living with Yahweh is the land of Yisrael. That this little tiny sliver of land at the crossroads of the world, God specifically, Yahweh, specifically gave to Yisrael. Now, it's interesting that in the Quran, doesn't Allah also claim to have given Yisrael to the Jews?
This is the most remarkable thing. Contrary to all the propaganda, the falsehoods disseminated by the Muslims and their supporters, in four major verses in the Quran. Allah says the following. It is actually Allah in the Quran, in crystal clear Arabic, who bequeathed the promised land to the Israelites and their descendants, the Jews, contrary to the assertions of the Arabs who falsely claim it as their own, overruling their God Allah's explicit instructions. Al-Ma'idah 5.21. O my people Israel, enter the holy land which Allah had assigned unto you. In Arabic it says, Ya qawmi, udkhulu al-arza al-muqaddasata allati kataba Allahu lakum. There is absolutely no ambiguity in what it says.
So how can Muslims claim it for? So how can Muslims claim it for themselves when their God says that He gave it to the Jews? The only way they could claim it for themselves is to have their God be a liar.
But that's exactly what's happening all the time. They refute their own scripture. For example, they accuse the Jews of being racist and
bigoted?
The word. Not just racist, because they claim they are a chosen people. But in fact, in several verses in the Quran, in Arabic, it is Allah who says to the followers of Muhammad, in clear Arabic, that it is He, Allah, who chose Am Israel, Bani Israel, or the Israelites, above all the other nations of the world at that time.
Why is the Torah then says that it was Yahweh who gave the promised land, Yisrael, to Yehudim? And how can the Quran say that it confirms the Torah when in one book it is Yahweh who is doing this, and the other book it is a God named Allah who is doing it?
Of course, because Allah, according to the Muhammadan Muslims, is Yahweh. This is how they deceive people.
But how is that possible when Yahweh, in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, says, I have but one name, and a God by any other name is false?
Because it is false. This is the whole point. People who don't know the Bible, people who don't know the Quran, never read the Quran or the Bible, are confused. They honestly believe that what the Muslims tell them is the truth. But what the Muslims tell them are lies upon lies upon lies. It's a bodyguard of lies. That's what the Quran is all about, a bodyguard of lies.
So here we have two evidences against Islam. One is that Muslims universally are enraged and want to attack and kill Jews, and they almost universally. If you were to take a thermometer of the temperature of Islamic rage, and pin it to a unifying issue, it would be the Jews inappropriately occupying the land known as Israel, and them needing to be driven out. That would be the single most unifying theme amongst Muslims worldwide. And yet, point one is their God says that He gave it to them, which means there is no basis for their rage. And second, the very statement of their God, Allah giving it to them, is a lie because it was Yahweh who gave it to them, and therefore you have proof twice over that the Quran is a pile of rubbish and that Islamic rage there is such thing as, I would say, as a justifiable rage. You know, if somebody does something horrid without reason to a child of yours, you're going to be enraged justifiably. When you look at what Islam has done to the world, that's justifiable rage. But the Islamic rage against Israel occupying their homeland is not justifiable, even according to their own God.
With all due respect, the tragedy is not the Muslims. The tragedy is many in the West, including politicians, clergy, and academicians, who perpetrate exactly the same lie. This is the most remarkable thing.
Yes.
The people in the West aid and abet the very people, the Muhammadan Muslims, who are attempting to destroy them. This is the tragedy.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to agree with that. Islam is only a problem because those who have the opportunity to know better, those who have the opportunity to do and say the right thing, don't. As a matter of fact, those who are in a place where evidence and reason are still available and opportunistic, have chosen to side with a lie. And so the only reason that Islam is a threat today, the only reason that Islam is able to murder and terrorize today, is because of the stupidity and the immorality of our politicians, of those in the media, of those in academia, and those in clerical positions. It's our fault that this religion still exists.
It is our fault. It really is. This is the tragedy. Because the agenda of the Muhammadan Muslims has been crystal clear for 1400 years.
Correct.
1400 years ago, as you well know, Muhammad unilaterally declared total war against all the human beings who do not believe in him, especially him, as the prophet of Allah and his God Allah.
Yeah.
It's crystal clear.
And if you look at the Quran and in all of the surahs that were allegedly revealed in Mecca before Muhammad went to Medina, there is one unifying theme in all of those, and that's the never-ending argument. And in it, it is absolutely obvious, undeniable, that the people who knew Muhammad best, those that he grew up around, all knew that he was a liar, a fraud, that he was demon-possessed, and that he was a madman who was doing all of this for his own personal gain. This has never been a secret.
This is the most beautiful thing about the Quran, if there is any beauty. It tells the facts. It actually reveals the facts. Yeah. That while Muhammad was trying to convert his own people to believe in him, they denied him because they knew he was a liar. They knew he was a charlatan. They knew he was a mass murderer. They knew he was a serial rapist. They knew.
Right.
So the only way he was able to impose his belief system upon them was through terrorizing them into submission.
Yeah, and if you look at his situation in Mecca, over 10 to 12 years of him claiming that he was the messenger of God, a God who, by the way, he did not call all at the time. He called that God Ar-Rahman at the time because he didn't want to impugn his own testimony by his inability to get the top rock of the Kaaba to roll over or crack up or do something miraculous. So he referred to his God as Ar-Rahman. But during that 12 years, fewer than 70 people came to believe him. Well, welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Jay Gatter. We're here with my good friend, IQ Al-Rasuli, the author of Lifting the Veil, The True Faces of Muhammad and Islam. IQ, you know, I may have exaggerated a bit. If you read the Hadith, there's about 10 to 15 names that seem to be individuals who hightailed it out of Mecca with Muhammad following the satanic verses and the embarrassment of the made-up wild ass ride to Jerusalem. And yet there are some places that say that he had as many as 70 followers. But 12 years he did this, and he convinced effectively 10 to 15 individuals to follow him.
Yes, but most of these people were either thugs who were his companions, slaves of his, wives of his, or friends of his. He did not convince anybody in the hierarchy of the Quraysh tribe. They all knew that he was a charlatan.
Yeah, that is true. And it wasn't until that he went up to towards Yathrib, today's Medina, that on the way there he met with a dozen pagan Arabs, and he told those pagan Arabs that if they were to wage war against all humankind and kill for him, that they would receive all sorts of benefits in Allah's paradise, his brothel. But what in reality he did that enabled Islam to grow is two things. He told men that they had total and complete dominion over women. They could do with women whatever they wished to do, and that if they fought for him, that they could keep 80% of the spoil for themselves. that they could rape the captive women, that they could enslave the captive children, they could kill the men, and they could steal their property. And it was based upon that exclusively that Islam grew.
Absolutely right. Because he was literally the foremost leader of the first organized crime syndicate in human history.
Yeah, it is absolutely
based
true.
In Medina.
Yeah, it is true. It was a crime syndicate. It was a horrible situation. Now, I want to move to point 21 because this is a place where we're going to disagree, but we're going to disagree in a way that will cause us actually to agree in the end. So if you'll play along with me here, IQ, your point 21 says that the Quran says that Muhammad was predicted in the Torah when it can be easily shown that this is a lie. Would you like to comment on that point? And then I'm quite certain that I'm going to take the opposite point of view, but in the end, it'll be because we actually agree.
Okay. In fact, the Torah instructs the Israelites. In Deuteronomy 13.2-4, it says, if there arises amongst you a prophet or a dreamer, urging you to follow other gods, pay no attention to the words of that prophet or dreamer. In Sahih al-Bukhari, Hadith 5.277, narrated by Abu Huraira, the Prophet said, had only 10 Jews believed me, all the Jews would definitely have believed me. Muhammad fitted this description so completely that among the tens of thousands of Judaized Arabs in the Arabian Peninsula, not even 10 individuals were willing to follow Muhammad even upon pain of death. I can't add more to that.
Yeah, unfortunately, you actually know the answer. Muhammad was predicted in the Torah, but in a hideous and ugly way. You read one of the two places that he was predicted, which is Deuteronomy 13. By the way, it doesn't speak exclusively of Muhammad. It also speaks of Shaul, who is known to us today as Paul. In the 18th chapter of Devarim, which has been corrupted to Deuteronomy, we find the place where virtually all Muslims now attest is the place that Muhammad was mentioned, because it speaks of a prophet coming after Moshe, whom we've corrupted to Moses. But this is what it says in Devarim 18:20. Surely, a person who proclaims a message on behalf of a deity, who oversteps their bounds and speaks presumptuously and contemptuously, who has an inflated sense of self-worth, demonstrating self-reliance while taking liberties to defy, who arrogantly pretends to know, who insults others and disrespectful, who displays pride in pursuit of personal recognition and acclaim while despising rivals, who rebels against that which is established and is prone to rage, who seethes with anger and is often furious, overbearing, rude, conceited in their plans, for the express purpose of conveying a statement or a message in my name, which accordingly I have not expressly appointed or entirely directed them to speak, and who speak in the name of other gods, indeed then, that prophet, he is deadly. So it is true that Muhammad is spoken of in the Torah. It's just that God says that this arrogant, seething idiot is deadly, not divine. Welcome back to Shattering Myths IQ. You're no fun today. Here I thought that I would be able to show that your statement that the Quran predicting or stating that Muhammad was predicted in the Torah was untrue is a complete lie when you in fact know the answer. Muhammad was in fact predicted in the Torah in both the 13th and 18th chapters of Devarim. It's just that it doesn't predict him in a good way, but instead in a horrid way, saying that he is arrogant, presumptuous, enraged, and that what he is saying is untrue, and that he is in fact deadly. It's a pretty accurate depiction of the man, don't you think?
It is, but I don't want us to confuse the people who are listening. As far as the Muslims are concerned, Muhammad's name was predicted in the Torah, and this is the lie.
Oh, of course,
not
there's no...
The attributes are exactly what you said they are, but his name is not mentioned.
Yeah, and of course, they not only say that his name is mentioned, that a prophet speaking to Arabs would be mentioned, and that it was mentioned favorably. He isn't mentioned by name. It is interesting, by the way, that Sheol, who is the Paul, the founder of Christianity, is actually mentioned by name, and it says very similar things about Sheol. Shaul, if you prefer, Paul, as it says about Muhammad, they were birds of a similar feather. The next statement I always have fun with. It is your number 23 among the statements of the Quran that show the Quran to be untrue. And the more people know that the Quran is untrue, the more comfortable they will be exposing and condemning this destructive and deadly religion. You write that Muhammad, in his alleged night journey, landed in Jerusalem, when in fact the name Jerusalem is never mentioned in the Quran, while it appears 667 times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms.
Yes, this is also another remarkable thing. I mean, what I find astounding is that all the facts are written in the Quran, which destroy the Quran by itself.
Right.
The verse that they are mentioning, there was only one verse in the whole of the Quran that alleges or implies a flight to Jerusalem. It's called Al-Isra 17.1.
Mm-hmm.
Glory to Allah who did take his servant for a journey, Isra, traveled by night from the sacred mosque, Al-Masjid al-Haram, to the furthest mosque, Al-Masjid al-Aqsa. In Arabic, for those who listen, Subhanu alladhi asra bi'abdihi laylan من المسجد الحرام إلى المسجد الأقصى الذي باركنا حوله لنريه من آياتنا إنه السميع البصير.
Was there a mosque?
Jerusalem is not mentioned.
Was there a mosque there in Jerusalem?
And there was no mosque in Jerusalem.
No.
In fact, you
know what Jerusalem actually means in Hebrew?
You tell me.
Okay. It's based upon the same verb that defines the word Torah. It's Yara. And Yara is the source from which teaching, direction, guidance, and direction flow. And then the second half of Jerusalem is from Shalom, which means reconciliation. So it is the source from which teaching, guidance, and direction regarding reconciliation flow. It is all about, it's the city that enables the promises of the covenant relationship. So Jerusalem is the center of Yahweh's acts among humankind. And so the reason that HaSatan, whom Allah is modeled after, wants his messenger to go to Jerusalem, even though he doesn't want to mention the name for fear that somebody understands what the name means, is because Allah's ambition is to destroy anything that Yahweh loves. Now, it is the next statement is also interesting. And before we go to it, by the way, how does the Quran say that Muhammad skedaddled that night to the furthest mosque? How did he get there?
It doesn't. That's the whole point. The Muslim exegetes disagreed. Some said it was a physical transport. Others said it was a spiritual transport. I, of course, accept the spiritual one because it makes more sense. Simply because it doesn't say where the Al-Masjid al-Aqsa is. By the way, I have proven beyond a shadow of a doubt in my books later on that Al-Masjid al-Aqsa was not on land. It wasn't on earth. Al-Masjid al-Aqsa was the throne of Allah.
Yeah, I agree with you.
In the Shemayim.
Yeah, I agree with you. But there is a discussion of a wild ass, a winged ass, that was the transport.
Al-Barak.
Al-Barak being the mode of transport that he got there by writing a wild ask. Aisha, who was the young girl that Muhammad savaged when he was in his 50s and she was 6 at the time, he was sleeping with her at the time, and she says, you know, I was there, and he never left his room.
By the way, she wasn't the only one. There were two wives at the time when he was sleeping with them.
Yes.
And both of them said he didn't leave physically.
Yeah, so which means he
was... This is another thing. I said it many times before, I'll repeat it again. Quran and Hadith self-destruct.
Correct.
This is fundamental. It is absolutely true. It is a factual, even if I don't want to use the word truth, because it's subjective. It is a fact.
Yeah.
Quran and Hadith self-destruct with their own words.
Correct.
Doesn't
That's reason
to Jerusalem anywhere, and yet the Muslims say he went to Jerusalem. Well, on what basis? The Quran is the holiest book that they have. It doesn't mention Jerusalem.
Right.
In the Hadith, nowhere in the Hadith will you find the word Jerusalem. By the way, in the Hadith it's called Iliya, which is the Roman emperor's, the Roman designation of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
It never mentions Jerusalem anywhere in the Hadith and anywhere in the Quran. So
amazing.
How did they come to the conclusion he went to Jerusalem?
Well, because they were covered
twice.
Because
he went to Iliya. And Iliya was Jerusalem.
Yeah. The next point that you raise is that Muhammad claims to have prayed at the head of all of the deceased prophets in the temple in Jerusalem, when in fact there was no temple standing in the days of Muhammad, because it had been destroyed by the Romans 500 years earlier. It was restored by the Romans in 6970 CE. So how is it possible that Muhammad could have gone to a temple when that temple no longer existed and had not existed for 500 years?
I mean, the answer self-destructs. As I said, it self-destructs. The answer is there. How could you go to a place that didn't exist? By the way, in the Hadith, and only in the Hadith, not in the Quran, in the Hadith, he even described the temple, which didn't exist. The most important thing is, we have here resurrection time. Because for him to pray at the head of all the previous prophets, they must have been resurrected. Another destruction.
Right.
There was no resurrection. The idea of resurrection is supposed to be at the end of time.
According
to... So how was they resurrected for him to pray at the head of them?
Right. And in Quranic,
if you understand,
no, of course not. I mean, Muhammad speaks of the day of doom and of the day of resurrection, and it has obviously not occurred. Although Muhammad said that his timing would be 500 years after his death, and that obviously true to be a false prophecy. That's the basis of the name of the book, Prophet of Doom, was Muhammad's insistence that this would occur 500 years after his death, And yet he was claiming that it was actually occurring specially for him. Now, he also says that he saw Moses there. Moses is the scribe of the Torah, who had died prior to the entry into Jerusalem, prior to crossing the Jordan River, around 1400 BCE. So... at that point, Moses, there isn't even anything left of Moses' bones by that point.
We're talking about 2,100 years after Moses was dead, that Muhammad resurrected him and saw him in Jerusalem. As you said, Moses never went to the land of Israel. He was not allowed.
Yeah, who was
the Jordan River?
We both quoted from...
Muhammad saw him.
Right. We both quoted from a passage in Devarim. You quoted from the 13th chapter. I quoted from the 18th chapter of Devarim. Who was the actual author? Now, because Devarim is different than the first four books of the Torah. The first four books in the Torah are primarily in Yahweh's voice. Devarim is in Moshe's voice. Moshe is going before the people and saying, "This is what God told us." And that is, so in Devarim, the voice of, this is how you recognize a false prophet, is in Moshe's voice. So if Moshe, who is the one that told us how to recognize a false prophet like Muhammad, met with Muhammad, what would he have done with Muhammad? Would he have prayed with Muhammad? or would he have recognized Muhammad was deadly and deceitful?
Well, there is no... it's obvious. I mean, the answer should be obvious.
Yeah.
He would not have prayed with Muhammad. But, I mean, it is inconceivable to even imagine such an idea that Muhammad could be praying at a place that did not exist, at a temple that did not exist, with creatures who have been dead for at least 2,100 years before he was, allegedly praying. I mean, it's preposterous. It is beyond human comprehension.
Let me just throw another one at you.
Is not required for Muslims.
Right. So let me throw another one at you. Muhammad said that the act that they were engaged in was prayer. Do you know how many times that Yahweh encourages us to pray or speaks about prayer in the Torah?
Never.
Never. Never. You know, God's whole idea is, you know, I know a little bit more about life and about the universe and about the covenant and about your salvation than you do. So perhaps the best plan here is for you to recite my testimony in the Torah and listen to me, maybe for you to observe what I have written for you, and then after you've read it and you've thought about it, you can respond. But God doesn't say, I want you to babble to me. I mean, that's the lie. Why would God want to listen to us babble all day long?
And so, there is no reason. He's the creator of the universe. He doesn't need people to babble to him.
No. And so the whole idea of the Muslim fixation on prayer, and also the Christian one, because Paul, was inspired by the same demonic spirit, is completely incongruous with Yah's testimony. The next point that you raised, number 26, is that Allah is merciful and compassionate. Now, this is said of Allah in all but one of the surahs. It begins now with this statement that Allah is merciful and compassionate. When we return to Shattering Myths after the break, I'm going to have IQ al-Rasuli show that this is an irrational statement. We'll be back in a moment. Hello and welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. We have my good friend IQ al-Rasuli on the line from us, calling in from Europe. IQ, it's always been a laugh to me that all but one of the surahs begin in the name of Allah, most benevolent, ever merciful. And yet the God who is depicted in the pages of the Quran spends all of his time in hell. He is the sponsor of terror, and he is, when his actions are depicted, they're always depicted as torturous in hell. So how is it that Allah is merciful and compassionate?
First of all, I would like to enlighten the listeners. The chapter that is missing with the start of merciful and compassionate, Al-Rahman al-Rahim, is chapter 9, At-Tawbah, which is the most deadly of all of the chapters of the Quran. So in the most important chapter, that merciful and compassionate is missing.
Yeah, the interesting thing there, let me just, can I add something there? The ninth chapter is the second to last revealed in the Quran in terms of the order of things. And the purpose of the ninth chapter is to exonerate Muhammad for reneging on his promises not to terrorize or torture Meccans for 10 years. He comes down upon Mecca with full force of arms, and he promptly conquers the place, killing and torturing many people in the process. But also the ninth surah exists to tell Muslims, since they have now overhunted Jews, that Allah will not tolerate a peaceful, compassionate, or merciful Muslim, that all Muslims must be merciless jihadists or they cease to be Muslims. And if they aren't merciless and they aren't tyrannical and vicious, that he wants good Muslims to kill them so that he can attend to their torture in hell. Is that not correct?
It is correct. That Allah is merciful and compassionate is a statement when in fact he is neither. Since he predestines humanity, the Allah, the God of Islam, predestines humanity to be either believers who end up in Muhammad's whorehouse version of paradise, or disbelievers who are 80% of current humanity to end up in his hell. I'll give you the readings of the following verses which are really relevant. And Imran 3.145, he says, nor can a soul die by except by Allah's leave, and the term being fixed as by writing. And An'am 6.59, not a leaf doth fall, but with his knowledge, that is Allah. There is not a grain in the darkness or the depths of the earth, nor anything fresh or dry, but it is inscribed in a record clear, that's a book, to those who can read, إِلَّا فِي كِتَابٍ مُبِينٍ, that means everything is inscribed in a book prior to their creation. This verse represents one of the clearest declarations of the concept of predestination in the Quran.
So,
this concept, ladies and gentlemen, degrades the human faculty and spirit by straitjacketing it into whatever status it is born to. Back to yours.
Yeah, IQ, it's, there are two reasons to recognize that Allah can be neither merciful nor compassionate. One of them is that if every soul is predestined, there is no opportunity for mercy or compassion. It is impossible to be merciful or compassionate when, in fact, every soul is predestined. And second, when Allah is only depicted, the only depictions of Allah in the Quran have Allah terrorizing, killing, or perpetrating horrible tortures in hell, then there is no opportunity whatsoever to see Allah as merciful and compassionate. He is the antithesis of these things.
Absolutely right. Ladies and gentlemen, neither intellectually nor morally can this concept of predestination be acceptable, since it makes Allah guilty of being unjust, immoral, and full of hate, as he condemns many of humanity to punishments for committing crimes that they weren't forced to do because they were predestined to do them. So
let me
the compassion and mercy of a God called Allah.
Yeah. Also, to keep in mind, the Christian concept of predestination comes from Calvin, who relied exclusively on Pauline doctrine. Paul was very much like Muhammad, was inspired by the same demonic spirit. And so the Christian myth of predestination is akin to the Islamic myth of predestination. Yahweh's position on this is the antithesis. Yahweh's tradition is that I gave you free will. I want you to exercise free will. And the only way you can exercise free will is to observe what is happening around you and respond to it in a thoughtful and rational way. And so, once again, we find Yahweh and Allah to be total opposites. One interested in submission and predestination, the other interested in choice, under the auspices of free will.
Alex Jones here with a message that could revolutionize health in this country. Going back about a year and a half ago, I began to learn about the incredible health effects of young